Well, I woke up the morning after Shavuos only to find that there is yet more Torah to learn, Baruch Hashem. So we find ourselves headed towards Parshas Noso, the longest of the Parshios, and there is an interesting assembly, shall we say, of mitzvahs. There's Sota, and there's Nazir, and there's Duchening, there in the center of the Parsha. And I'd like to devote a few comments to the mitzvah, the section of Nazir. It's a very interesting from so many points of view. You have this individual, for whatever reason, he has taken upon himself to secede to a certain degree, for a certain time, from society. He wants to protect himself, he wants to distance himself, and perhaps gain control of things that otherwise he fears might gain control of him. He's the Nazir. And in fact, he's already a rare individual. And according to the Ibn Ezra, Nazir comes from the word Nezer, which is a crown. The Torah is very complimentary about this person. What's his great achievement? That he cares enough to do battle with his Yetzirah and come out on top. Now, interestingly, the Torah does not explicitly discuss the duration of the term of Nazirus. On the one hand, it's clear that it must come to an end at some stage, because the Torah describes the korbanos that the Nazir brings upon the completion of his term, which means that we know that it is finite, although halachically a person can become a Nazir for life if he wants to, but certainly Nazirus, all things being equal, is a finite duration. But the Torah doesn't say how long the standard, shall we say, term of Nazirus is. Now we know that in fact the standard term of Nazirus is 30 days, as the Halacha states it, Stam Nazirus Shloshim Yom. The Gemara, interestingly, associates this, or attaches it, and states as its source the word Yihyeh. The Pasuk says in the context of Nazirus, Kadosh Yihyeh. Yihyeh has the numerical value of 30. Yud and Hey is 15, another Yud and Hey, another 15 is 30. But be that as it may, and the Rambam actually states in his Perush to the Mishnayos that it was always known. We didn't need to wait till someone told us the gematria of the word Yihyeh till we found out that the standard term of Nazirus is 30 days. It was of the Perushim HaMekubolim. It was something that was known. It then became attached to the word Yihyeh, what's known as an Asmachta. So it's quite interesting that although the Torah gives us many details about the Nazir, but it doesn't tell us how long your Stam Nazirus should last. And Meshech Chochma discusses this. Meshech Chochma says very interestingly that, and it touches on a broader question, but we focus on the application here, what difference does it make when we know something through Torah Shebaal Peh, or when something is stated explicitly in Torah Shebichtav? Halachically, they're the same. But it could be, in this case, atmospherically, that there's a difference. But the truth of the matter is, says Meshech Chochma, how long should Nazirus last? However long it takes. If you have a Nazir who needs 2 months or 3 months, let it be 2 months or 3 months. As if to say, the Torah almost wishes to de-emphasize the 30-day period, true though it is that if it's not specified, it will be 30 days, but it doesn't wish to highlight the 30 days, because the moral of the story is not that your average Nazir needs 30 days. It's just if you didn't specify, it's not going to be longer. But in order to give precedence almost to each Nazir, however long it takes, that's the correct answer. If he doesn't say it one way or the other, then it defaults to 30 days. And that's why the Lamed Yom is left in the realms of Torah Shebaal Peh. It's something that we know, and you need to know it, but it isn't promoted, shall we say, as even the ideal term of Nazirus. It's just the default. Having said that, the standard term is 30 days. And the word in the Pasuk to which it is attached is the word Yihyeh. And that also requires some contemplation. because there's many words in the Parsha of Nazir, and each one has a different gematria. But of course, we know that it's 30, and therefore we find, so to speak, the word in the Parsha that has the gematria of 30. But does it teach us anything about being a Nazir? So one of the recently published Sfarim is by the name of Mimini Michael. We've quoted from it once before. Rav Michal Fodor, Shalita, lives here, one of the wonderful Talmidei Chachamim of Yerushalayim. And he explains, in many areas of halacha, we find that 30 days is the period whereby something new can be learnt, a new trait, a new habit. Thus we find, for example, when the Nusach of the davening changes from Vesein Bracha to Vesein Talamata Lebracha, from Moed Atal to Mashiv HaRuach. So you've got that incubation period of 30 days whereby you're presumed to have said the way you have been saying until now. But once a person is schooled and once a person has become fluent over that 30-day period, we now consider them, all things be, if we don't know, the assumption is that he said it the new way. Because 30 days allows a person to acquire a new way. And so it is in other areas of halacha. Interestingly, your average month is 30 days, and the word for month is chodesh, which is a chiddush. It allows a person to it's a new frame, allows a person to insinuate and to attain and acquire something new. What's also interesting is that as the ideas kind of loop in on each other, the letter in Lashon HaKodesh, which has the numerical value of 30, is Lamed. And every letter also has a connotation, and not surprisingly, the connotation of Lamed is Lamed. That is to say, it's about learning, because Lamed, the number, 30, is the time over which a person learns something and acquires something else. And therefore, says Rav Fodor, the word that we choose is the word Yihyeh. The reason being, Yihyeh means it will be. And certainly as far as the Gemara is concerned, the term Yihyeh has a connotation of it will remain thus. And that's the point. As if to say, the goal of a Nazir is that whatever he learns while he's a Nazir, whatever positive traits he acquires, they should be there to stay. We're looking for Yihyeh. In order to learn, in order to lamed a new trait, it takes 30 days, and the result should be Yihyeh. So that's Rav Fodor's comment, which gives us deeper insight into this asmachta, into this word Yihyeh that is so important now for its numerical value. You need 30 to get a Yihyeh result. But what's very interesting is, he leaves it unspoken, but other Mefarshim have discussed this, it turns out that our horizons with regards to Nazir go way beyond his period of Nazirus. As if to say, the positive traits that he acquires are meant to stay with him even as he is no longer a Nazir. That's the point. 30 days should lead to Yihyeh, and when the 30 days are up, he should remain with all those positive things, even as he's no longer a Nazir. It could be that what led him to be a Nazir is that he lost his balance in terms of partaking of this world. But as he regains his equilibrium and regains his clarity of perspective and re-engages in society, in the world, he should do so with the perspective of that he gained when he was a Nazir. And the Al-Sheikh very beautifully points this out by referring us to the Pasuk at the end of the section of Nazir, where he's been through the whole thing, and he's brought his korbanos, and he's cut his hair, and he's back again, and the final psukim of this section are Va'achar yishte hanazir yayin, and after that the Nazir shall drink wine. So the Al-Sheikh says, without putting too fine a point on it, if we've been paying attention, he's not a Nazir anymore. That's the whole point. A Nazir can't drink wine. The reason why he can is because he's not a Nazir anymore. So why does the Pasuk, as it describes him going back to drink wine, persist in calling him a Nazir? Isn't that the whole thing? He's not a Nazir. But the point is, says the Al-Sheikh, no, he should remain a Nazir even as he goes back to drink wine, because he should be partaking of the world in the way that wine represents, in a Nazirdic way. You know, with all the clarity that he attained as a Nazir. So the goal of Nazirus, while he's a Nazir, he abstains from wine, but the goal is, as a Nazir, he should re-engage and drink wine and all that is associated therewith. And perhaps one may add, it's very interesting to ponder and to contemplate the, again, assembly seemingly of restrictions that converge upon the Nazir. There are three main areas, and they don't seem to really have much to do with each other. The one is that he's not allowed to drink wine. The second is he's not allowed to cut his hair. And the third is he's not allowed to become Tommy LeMays. Now, seemingly, these three things are completely unrelated. One can imagine people that have one, but not the other. A Kohen can't be Tommy LeMays, it's got nothing to do with anything else. So how do these three come together? Well, seemingly, at the center here is his abstaining from wine, representing, again, the pleasures of Olam Hazeh and all of the things that wine can bring a person to. He just wants to keep that at bay until he refines his equilibrium. So that's what's behind the Yozir Atzmo Min Hayayin, seems to be at the heart, shall we say, of Nazirus. It's also true that he doesn't cut his hair. And Rav Hirsch discusses this. And Rav Hirsch says that when a person grows their hair, as surely as physically it is, in a sense, surrounds them and insulates them almost, and that represents the Nazir, he is being insulating, he is seceding, he is separating and being in a realm all of his own. And therefore, with regards to wine, he withdraws. And with regards to his hair, he kind of withdraws from everyone else. He's unto himself. But then comes the third prohibition, which is very interesting because it seems seemingly nothing to do with anything. He is forbidden to become Tomei LeMays. How does this relate to the broader picture of Nazir? Perhaps one may suggest that it's very easy. A person might be prone, as he sees perhaps the ugliness, or he sees the fickleness of life and the things that it can lead to. Perhaps as he distances himself from what life can become, he may end up giving up almost on life itself, as if to say he condemns the whole thing, it's not worth it. And these thoughts, which are rather morose, could overtake a person who secedes from society. He looks at everyone else, they don't know what they're doing, they're wasting their time, they're involved in foolishness, and that's life. But the Torah says, that's not life. And the goal of the Nazir is to find life. He may have exposed, either within others, or more meaningfully, within himself, a tendency towards perhaps some of the weaker aspects of life. His goal is not to distance himself from life, it's to find a higher way of living. And to that end, the Torah is most insistent. He can have no contact with the dead. He can have no contact with Misa, because he needs to be more distance himself from death than he distances himself from life, in order to reinforce the idea that all that he is doing during his time of Nazirus is life-affirming and life-promoting. It's very interesting that of the three, as far as I'm aware, it's the halacha, of the three prohibitions of the Nazir, the only one that can undo his Nazirus, that can absolutely reset from start, is if he becomes into contact with the dead. It's not true for other things, as much as he will violate Torah prohibitions if he cuts his hair or if he drinks wine, but certainly the Torah only talks about resetting the Nazirus. He's like ruined everything, he's undone everything if he comes in contact with mace, which seems to give that a level of severity that the others don't have, because heaven forbid that all of his Nazirus should take him in that direction. That needs to be distanced more than anything else. So thus perhaps we can understand the way that these three prohibitions of the Nazir go together. While we're on the topic of Nazir, I'd like to move past the end of the Parsha to the Haftorah, because the Haftorah actually deals with Nazirus. It's about Shimshon, and the connection is because Shimshon was a Nazir. And as we know, the story, just to cue us in, Manoach and his wife, childless for many years. And then this angel appears to Manoach's wife and tells her she will have a child, but he's going to be a Nazir. And to that end, because she is bearing him, she will carry him. She's a Nazir from birth. From this point, even she can't partake of the things that a Nazir cannot partake of. And that, if we take a look in... it's Shoftim, Perek Yud Gimel. He says to her in Pasuk, hey, ki hinach hara v'yoladet ben, you will conceive, you'll bear a son, umor lo yale al rosho, which some take to mean that his hair will not be cut, a blade will not pass by his head, ki nazir lo kim yehanar mi beten, because he'll be a Nazir for Hashem. The pasuk before then, he tells her that she cannot partake of these things. You need to take care. You can't partake of wine in any form because you're the mother and he's going to come from you. Now, Manoach's wife goes to her husband, tells him what happened, and interestingly, Manoach wants to hear it for himself, and asks if they can recall the Malach so he can hear the message personally, which he does. And therefore, as the Pasuk says, Hashem listened to Manoach's request, the Malach came back, and Manoach addresses him, Pasuk Yudreis, Vayoma Manoach, Ataya Vot Varecha, speak now, Ma'ye Mishpatanar Uma'aseyu, what should we do? How should we raise him? And now, Pasuk Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet, the Malach reiterates his earlier instructions to Manoach's wife. He now repeats, Vayoma Malach Hashem Manoach, Mikol Asher Amarti El Ha'isha Tishamer. Everything that I told your wife, Tishamer. I would like to leave the word Tishamer untranslated just for now. Next pasuk, Mikol Asher Yetze Migefen Hayayin, anything that comes out from the vine, Lo Tochal, B'yayin V'shechar Al Teisht. Now, on the one hand, a repetition, but the Meshech Chochma raises an interesting question. Because, as we know, the way Lashon HaKodesh works is that when you use a word like Tochal or Tishamer, it's actually the same word that can be referring to second person masculine and third person feminine. Tishamer can either be addressing a male, you take care, or referring to a female, she should take care. That's the way it goes. Lo tochal either means you shall not eat, or she shall not eat. And Meshech Chochma says, and just it's a very brief comment, I'm not 100% certain, where when the Malach says, Mikol Asher Amarti Eleisha Tishamer, everything I told your wife, Tishamer, it means she should take care, or Tishamer, you should take care. Mikol Asher Yetze Migefen HaYayin Lo Tochal means she can't eat, or you can't eat. Yayin V'shecha Al Teisht, she can't drink, or you can't drink. I'm not sure, says Meshech Chochma. And Mefarshim raised the question, but what type of a question is this? What type of a doubt is this? As if to say, the Malach was quite clear that it's the mother, she's the one who's carrying Shimshon, she's the one seemingly that her actions will have those reverberations, because he's already a Nazir, mi beten, so she has these prohibitions. What's Manoach got to do with anything? And Mefarshim, post Meshech Chochma, Mefarshim pick up the idea. And Shimon Schwab says something very interesting. He's the Rav of the shul in Washington Heights. It could be that the reason for saying that Manoach himself cannot partake of these things, even though he's not formally part of the Nazirus process, is because Shimshon, or the child, is going to grow up with him, and it will be unfeasible or untenable to have Shimshon avoiding all these things if his father partakes of them. As if to say, from day one, the message will be, well, you're a Nazir, so that's not okay for you, but your father can have whatever he wants. So then that's not going to take with him. Because in order to properly train him to naturally abstain for these things, they can't be in the house. Meaning even Manoach, who's not a Nazir, but if he wants to train a Nazir, so he has to act like one. And he has to abstain from all those things that a Nazir abstains from. And that what's being highlighted is that in order to train a child to do anything, to tell them to do one thing and then the parent does something else, so then that's not really asking for much success. But if the parent acts in that way as well, there's room to say one doesn't even need to say anything. And certainly if one does, it will be much better received. My son, Eliyahu, recently bar mitzvahed, well, zachur latov, he's already earning his stripes. He said a good vort at the Yom Tov table, where the Gemara says in Masechet Shabbos, harogel b'ner, a person is accustomed with a candle, so he will have children who are Talmidei Chachamim. Now on a mystical level, or perhaps on a cosmic level, we know the more light is Torah, you light lights, and then light is like Torah, if he's accustomed to have, and perhaps it's Ner Shabbos or Ner Chanukah, whatever the Ner is, that's a Segula. But the Peirush that he brought is when it says Harogel b'ner, if a person is accustomed with Ner, that means he's accustomed to use the light for learning. If he wants his children to be Talmidei Chachamim, so he can light as many lights as he wants. But if he lights the lights and goes out to wherever, so then the child is not going to really see much. Harogel b'ner means he himself is accustomed, that he lights the light and he sits down and learns by it. That's the best segula for the children to be likewise. So that's really the message that comes out from this, from Manoach's own non-nazirus abstaining for purposes of chinuch, of shimsha. Now, after the mitzvah of Nazir, we have in our parsha, interestingly, the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim, of Duchening. And that's towards the end of Perek Vav. And Duchening is one of the Tariq mitzvahs, as the Torah says, Amor Lehem, it's a coast of Aruchu, Amor Lehem, one of the Tariq mitzvahs. And it's interesting to discuss for just some moments the measure of this mitzvah, or the nature of this mitzvah. There is a very interesting statement of the Yerushalmi in Maseches Tanis. And the Yerushalmi, on the one hand, it will tell us what we already know, but this is how we know it. The Yerushalmi states that the mitzvah of Nesiyas Kapayim, the mitzvah of Duchening, can only take place within the context of Avoda. The source, I believe, is the juxtaposition. The Torah, when it talks about Birchas Kohanim, it describes the Kohanim as the ones that Hashem has chosen, L'sharso u'levarich b'shmo, to serve Him and to bless in His name. And that juxtaposition tells us that L'varich b'shmo only happens within the context of L'sharso. And indeed, we never find Birchas Kohanim. One could have imagined this and many other mitzvahs. They don't need to take place within the Avoda. They're their own mitzvah. They have their own space and their own time. But here we see no. When it comes to Birchas Kohanim, its time is within the context of Avoda. Now, this statement leads us to a very basic question. And that is, what are the implications of this statement for Birchas Kohanim Bizman Hazeh, in our time? When we think Avoda, the classic Avoda, the Torah, the Avoda, Gemes Hasadim, is Avodas HaKorbanos. In the Beis HaMikdash, they would duchen as part of the Avodas HaKorbanos. Nowadays, we temporarily do not have Avodas HaKorbanos. What are the implications for duchening? Now, it is true that whereas we do not have Korbanos, we do have the mitzvah of Tefillah, and we call Tefillah Avoda, and in fact, the Gemara calls Tefillah Avoda Shebelev. However, as we know, there is a major discussion, dispute in fact, amongst the Rishonim, as to whether Tefillah is a mitzvah, per se, whether there's a mitzvah to daven from the Torah. Obviously, it's part of our Jewish schedule. But is there a mitzvah from the Torah to daven? Well, Rambam famously says yes, once a day, something. That's the Oraisa. The Rabbanan gave us three tefillahs. But according to the Ramban and many others, there is no Torah obligation to daven on a daily basis. But then the question is, where does that leave Duchening? If we don't have Avoda of Karbonos, and the what we call the Avoda of Tefillah is itself not De'oraisa, it's not a Torah obligation, so where is there a Torah context for the Torah mitzvah of Nesias Kapayim? Could it be that Duchening nowadays, because of this, is not De'oraisa, is De'rabanan only? Well, parenthetically, I should mention, although he drew a lot of flack for saying this, the opinion of Rabbi Yaakov Emden, based on all the above, is yes, indeed. In the absence of Avoda De'oraisa, there is no Birchas Kohanim De'oraisa. But Rabbi Yaakov Emden received a great deal of response for saying that. And certainly the prevailing approach and opinion amongst the poskim is that Duchening is alive and well even today as a mitzvah de'oraisa. And in fact, a very interesting, just to quote one of the many proofs that are brought in this very interesting discussion, is from a Yerushalmi in Nazir. The Yerushalmi asked the question, is it mutter for a Kohen, if he's on his way to Duchen, can the mitzvah of Duchening set aside the prohibition of a Kohen becoming Tomei Meis? That's an interesting shaila. After all, we know, Asei do chalos asei, a positive mitzvah sets aside a negative prohibition. Could it be that the positive mitzvah of Duchening, it is the mitzvah, sets aside the negative prohibition of a Kohen be Tomei Lemeis? If the only way he can get to Shul, or the only way, whatever the situation is, whatever the scenario is. Now, one thing is quite clear, say the poskim. We are not talking about a Kohen who's going to Duchen in the Beis HaMikdash. Because if he's going to the Beis HaMikdash and enters there when he's Tomei Meis, he's Chayev Kores straight away. So we're not talking about going to the Beis HaMikdash. We're clearly talking outside of the Beis HaMikdash. But if it's outside the Beis HaMikdash, you don't have your Korbanos. What you have is Tefillah. And yet we see that the Yerushalmi is considering perhaps the positive mitzvah of Duchening overrides the negative prohibition. But a positive mitzvah, a rabbinic positive mitzvah, can't override a Torah prohibition. It must be that we rate the mitzvah of Duchening even outside the Beis HaMikdash as a Torah positive mitzvah, QED. That tells us that even outside the context of Avodas HaKorbanos, Duchening is a positive mitzvah. The question is, why? We're back to our original question. If Avoda is not a mitzvah de'oraisa, where is the de'oraisa Avoda setting for the de'oraisa mitzvah of Duchening? Well, the answer to this question, or there's many answers, but a very interesting answer is provided by Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. And Reb Chaim says, we are familiar with two types of mitzvahs. There is a mitzvah called chiyuvis. It is a standing obligation, which is actually most mitzvahs. And then there is a mitzvah which is called kiyumis. That is to say, there is no obligation on a Torah level to perform this mitzvah, but if you do, you have fulfilled a Torah mitzvah. That's called mitzvah kiyumis. Well, and perhaps a classic example at the risk of oversimplifying, there is no mitzvah for a person to wear a talis. But if he puts on a beged of Arba Kanfos, then he has the obligation of tzitzis. He can elect to put himself into that situation. It's not an exact example, but it's actually the easiest, at least for purposes of discussion. Well, says Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, when we say, or those who say, that tefillah, the mitzvah of tefillah is not de'oraisa, what they mean to say is there is no de'oraisa obligation to daven. But there is no question that if a person does daven, he is fulfilling a mitzvah de'oraisa. It's a mitzvah kiyumis, according to all opinions. And therefore, says Reb Chaim, when we say Shemona Esrei, which is the mitzvah of tefillah, which has the status of avoda, there is no obligation de'oraisa to do that. But the Torah recognizes it as avoda, for sure. And therefore you have your de'oraisa setting for the de'oraisa mitzvah of Duchening. And indeed, the point in the Chazan's repetition, where the Kohanim, they go up, they ascend, is the bracha of Ritzei, which is about Korbanos, all of this within the context of Tefillah. So that's just Perhaps would not have imagined that there is a debate or discussion as to whether Duchening is Daraisa nowadays and why it wouldn't be and why it ultimately is, but these are some of the highlights of that discussion. Now, Mi'inyan le'inyan, with regards to this mitzvah, there is a very mysterious, the only way really to describe it, the part of this mitzvah, and that is why it doesn't happen in Chutz La'aretz on a daily basis. Certainly, all things being equal, like any other mitzvah d'oraisa, which is not specified, it is a daily mitzvah, and therefore here in Eretz Yisrael, they duchen every day. I should perhaps be more precise. Minhag Ashkenaz in Chutz La'aretz is not to duchen every day, not even every week. It's only on Yom Tov, and only in Musaf on Yom Tov. It's a big thing. People wait. The Levium wait to wash the Kohen's hands. It's a big, it's an event, and rightly so. But the question is, how did it become such a rarity? And this was true from the times of the Rishonim. The Rama has words of explanation, and Rama says, it's a well-known statement of Rama, that in Chutz La'aretz people are harried and they don't have the menuchas ha-nefesh and they don't have the state of joy that the Kohen needs in order to bestow the Birchas Kohanim, which is very encouraging for people here in Eretz Yisrael, because that means that we do have all of that, even if it sometimes seems that we don't. Really, we do. and therefore says the Rama, you don't get to that state until it's Yom Tov, and even until Musaf of Yom Tov, even Shachris, you're not elevated enough. It's got to be Musaf. That's life in Chutz La'aretz. But here in Eretz Yisrael, every day, everyone's in that state, every day. Well, there were certain Gedolim who were not at peace with this, and sought to reinstitute duchening every day in their kehillas. And for one thing or another, it never worked out. Foremost amongst them is the Vilna Gaon. The Vilna Gaon did not recognize any reason not to duchen for all people in all places. And he sought to, he set a date, and from this date we're going to start duchening. And it's a matter of record on that. The very morning that he wanted to reinstitute duchening, he was arrested on a trumped-up charge. And then the whole thing just kind of got forgotten after that. His prime disciple, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, also sought to reinstitute duchening every day in Volozhin and set a date. And the night before that date, there was a fire that raged through half of Volozhin. The whole thing was put aside. And some people say at that stage they realized that it's not something that it is correct to reinstitute, even though no one can really explain why. Here, Baruch Hashem, in Eretz Yisrael, the minhag always has been to duchen every day. Although, interestingly, there is a minhag in the Galil, where they only duchen on Shabbos. And the understanding is that the difference between the two minhagim, whereby in Yerushalayim is duchening every day, and by extension any affiliate of Yerushalayim, in any default place, but in the Galil it's only on Shabbos. Where does Shabbos come from? That's not formally mentioned in any of the sources. But as they explain, the difference is that it was the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon who settled in Yerushalayim there in those early 1800s. The Talmidim of the Baal Shem Tov, they settled more in the Galil, Tiberia, and those places. And they were more inclined to keep on the minhag that they had back home by the Rebbe, where they never duchen, but on the other hand, here and there, almost never, I mean, only on Yom Tov, but here they duchen every day, and therefore Shabbos was almost seen like a middle ground between the two, whereas the Talmidim of the Vilna Gaon had no problem jettisoning any minhag of the Chutz La'aretz in this respect, because the Vilna Gaon, even the Chutz La'aretz, wanted to institute duchening every day, if only he could. And there the matter stands. And seemingly in Eretz Yisrael they duchen every day, and in Chutz La'aretz only on Yom Tov, and never the twain shall meet, and that those are the two minhagim. However, one of the great Sfardi Gedolim, the Maharam Chagiz, Rabbi Moshe Chagiz, he says something fascinating, and it's valuable information for any Kohen here in Eretz Yisrael. The Gemara states that any person who does not stand in front of the Kohanim when they're duchening, he doesn't partake of the blessing. As if to say, you're there, there's duchening, and you don't even place yourself where you receive the blessing, so you forfeit the blessing. But the Gemara says, you know, there's some people that are just too far away. They're called Am Shebesodos. People who work in the field, in the villages, they couldn't make it to Shul every day. So it's not so much that they make a point of not receiving the blessing from the Kohanim. They're just too far away. They're beyond reach. And the Gemara says, wherever they are, they receive the blessing. Am Shebesodos. Says Maram Chagiz, seeing as, for whatever reason, the minhag in Chutz La'aretz is that they don't duchen every day, people in Chutz La'aretz, world Jewry, diaspora Jewry, has the status of Am Shebesodos. So the Kohanim in Eretz Yisrael should have them in mind in their duchening every day. And in fact, a friend of mine, Talmud actually, who was a Kohen, who was close with the Moshe Sternbuch, who was makbid, of course, on, well, everything, and Moshe Sternbuch had to travel to Chutz La'aretz, and he asked him, he said, I'm going to Chutz La'aretz, I'll be there for such and such number of days, please have me in mind, I'm entering Am Shebesodos, have me in mind during your duchening every day. So that's it brings everyone together, pending the time when everyone really fully comes together. But these are some very interesting comments with regards to the mitzvah of Birchas Kohanim sourced in our parsha. From there, let us come to the final section of Parshas Noso, by virtue of which it is the longest parsha in the Torah, and that is the Chanukas HaNesiyim, the korbanos that were brought, offered on the first 12 days of the operation of the Mishkan. And that really gives us all of Perek Zion, which is, I believe, 89 psukim long because of the repetition. Now, if we look carefully at these psukim, we'll note that actually the initiative, shall we say, or the donations of the Nesiim were twofold in nature. There were two things that they brought. One each person for his day, and one for the ongoing operation of the Mishkan. And each one has a chiddush, as we'll see. The first thing that they brought were wagons and oxen. They all joined together, and they participated, and they donated these wagons and oxen for purposes of carrying the parts of the Mishkan when it would travel. That was part number one. And that's for as long as the Mishkan is in operation in the wilderness. The second thing that they offered were, of course, their famous korbanos, each one on its day. It's the laning for Hanukkah, korbanot, karas kesef lachaz. Each one offered his special korbanos. Each of these items, as we will see, each of these two categories has a chiddush. If we take a look in Perek Zayin, Pasuk Hey, which begins with the Pasuk before, Vayomar Hashem el Moshe Lemor, Kach Me'itam, take it from them. Now take what from them? If you have a look in Pasuk Gimel describes Vayaviu es Korbanan Lefnei Hashem, Shesh Aglos Tzav, 6 wagons, Ushnei Asar Bakar, and 12 oxen. Those are the first thing that they offered. And Hashem says to Moshe, take it from them, Kach Me'itam. Now that's actually quite interesting, because why does Moshe need to be told to take it from them? And if most people are not told to take donations to the shul. They take them. If they're being offered, then it's good. But Hashem specifically tells Moshe, take it from them. Does Moshe need to be told? Well, say the Mefarshim, and the basis really is in the Medrash, yes. Moshe needed to be told to take these wagons and oxen from the Nesiim, because he was not inclined to take them. He did not wish to receive them. Why not? Says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh and the Sforno, Hashem hasn't said anything about this. Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, has been very specific and explicit about the component parts of the Mishkan. It is what it is. And Hashem never breathed a word about having wagons to transport the Mishkan on. So this type of initiative is met with some reservations on the part of Moshe. Moreover, there's room to say that perhaps it's not correct to have them on wagons for a very simple reason. What's more bechavadik? What's more? What gives more honor to the things of the Mishkan, to the component parts? You put them on a wagon and lead them with oxen, or you carry them yourself? What will you say? They're heavy. So walk slowly. And therefore, it's not clear that it's even correct as far as covered for the mitzvah goes. The Nesi'im, for their part, they felt this is the correct way, it's so heavy, this will be, it's more effective. So you have an interesting, almost two perspectives here. Is it better? Is it good for the Jews to have these wagons and oxen to carry these parts of the Mishkan? The Nesi'im said yes, Moshe thinks no, and Hashem says, take it from them. But that's a chiddush. Accept it from them. In the words of the Medrash, Hiskima datam ledas el yona. Their understanding was aligned with the understanding of on high. That means HaKadosh Baruch Hu concurred with them that it is more bechavadik, or more correctly, it is more correct and it's appropriate to have these wagons. Maybe it's its own type of kavod, as if to say, this is where it's all arranged, it's all sorted, proceeds smoothly and nicely. But it's a very interesting situation because the fact remains, Hashem never said anything about it. He never told anyone to do this. And the Nesi'im, so to speak, of their own initiative came up with this idea. But it happens to be that Hashem concurred with that idea and Hashem judged that this is the correct way. What are we to make of a situation like this where it's correct, but Hashem has left it for people to intuit? It's a rare situation. And that's chiddush number one. Perhaps some things become correct when people intuit them. That's how Rav Kupperman formulates it. This mitzvah, it's almost like it's there, but it needs people to realize that's what they should do, and that actualizes it, so to speak. Otherwise, perhaps it would never have been said. That's a unique situation. Now, the korbanos of the Nesi'im likewise have chidushim. Firstly, in terms of their category, you don't need to look too closely at these korbanos in order to see that each nasi brings things that no individual ever brings under normal circumstances. For example, each nasi brings keteres to the Mishkan. An individual never brings keteres. Keteres is only ever sanctioned as avodas tzibur. In fact, without crossing our wires too much, Nadav and Avihu came to grief over offering Ketores as private individuals. But the Nesi'im did, and it was accepted. Moreover, the individuals, each one brought a chatos, a sin offering, even though there was no known sin that they brought a chatos for. An individual never does that. But all of this was accepted. Interestingly, in terms of the parshanut, to be thorough, the Ramban understands that the korbanos were also accepted by Hashem with the words kach me'ita. In other words, if we sweep through the psukim, it almost sounds like the earlier psukim are about the wagons and oxen, and about them Hashem said kach me'itam, and then the later psukim are about their korbanos, and no one said anything about that, Hashem included. It was purely voluntary, and there was no sanction given. It wasn't ratified or endorsed ever. But the Ramban is inclined to understand that actually all of the contents of this chapter were endorsed with the words kach me'itam. Not only the oxen and wagons, but also the animals for korbanos. Why does he say that? If you look in Pasuk Gimel, it only discusses the wagons and the oxen. There's no reference to korbanos. However, says Ramban, it seems that there is, because if you look at Pasuk Beis, which again, these are early psukim, Perek Zayin Pasuk Beis, vayakrivu nisya Yisrael, they offered. And moreover, Pasuk Gimel says, vayaviu es korbanan lefnei Hashem. They brought their korban. Now the question is, what is being referred to with the words korbanam? Says Ramban, when I see the word korban, I think korban. I mean, that's the pashtus. But there's no korbanos mentioned. It just talks about the wagons. So just in terms of parshanut, you could say one or two things. You could either say that in fact these psukim are only dealing with the wagons, and the word korban is used in a much broader sense than usual, as if to say, whereas normally it refers to an animal that's offered as a korban, but here it refers to something that was donated to the Mishkan, the wagons and the oxen. None of them were brought as korbanos. It's called a korban in a broad sense, you could say. And that's Ramban's first approach. But the second approach, says Ramban, is that in fact Vayaviu es korbanam refers to all the animals which were later to be brought as korbanos. They brought them in the wagons. That's how they presented the whole thing. Each one took his set of korbanos, each nasi, or team of nasiim, put them in the wagons and presented all of that to Moshe. And therefore, the pasuk Vayaviu es korbanam refers to korbanos in the classic sense of the word. That's in terms of resolving parshanut. But the implications are, if everything is referred to in Pasuk Gimel, then when Hashem says in Pasuk Hei, Kach Me'itam, He is endorsing all of the above. The wagons, the oxen, and the korbanos that are in the wagons. Okay, so that's an important discussion, again, just to understand what was endorsed within, formally or explicitly, within this perek. But as we move to the korbanos themselves, and we're familiar with the layout by Yom HaSheni, by Yom HaShlishi. It's very difficult to avoid the pattern of the laning of these korbanos, unless you're very determined. But for all the repetition, so to speak, and Ramban here too comments, there was one chiddush. So far we're saying that whatever the Nesi'im suggested, whatever they instigated, was all ratified, was all endorsed. Whatever they did, Hashem said, it's fine. So there's no input, so to speak, from Hashem's side other than to say, it's fine, it's all good. But in fact, says Ramban, it appears that Hashem, He modified, to a degree, their korbanos. How so? Because each of the Nesi'im, as they all brought their korbanos, and it's clear they brought them all together, they were all intending to bring their korban on day one. And from a certain point of view, why not? Day one is the day of Chanukah HaMishkan. Day two is Isru Chag. Day two is the day after Chanukah HaMishkan. It's already business as usual. It's Mishkan business as usual, but it's no longer Chanukah. And therefore, each one was intending to bring them on the first day. Hashem's chiddush, so to speak, His input as he tempered this mitzvah, was to say, I endorse everyone's korban. Here's what I'm now telling them, which they don't know. The correct way to do this is nasi echad layom, nasi echad layom. Each day should be a different nasi. That was a chiddush to them. And that is one of the reasons, says Ramban, why the Torah repeats the korban. Parshas Naso could have been much shorter. I mean, Shul could end much earlier in Parshas Naso. All you need is one or two psukim saying all the other nasiim did likewise, and you can make kiddush. But the pasuk goes over them one by one. Each nasi gets his space. Why? Because no one should suffer from the fact that although he wanted to bring it on the first day, he ended up bringing it on a later day. In deference to the fact that they equally wanted to bring their korban on the first day, as much as it's a different day, but it's like it's the first time again. That's one explanation of Ramban for the repetition. But to move into the way that the Nesi'im are introduced, and the Or HaChaim HaKadosh, who always has an eye for all these details, notes, who's first? The first one to go is, in Pasuk Yud Beis, is Nachshon. If we take a look at the Pasuk, Vayehi, HaMakriv B'Yom HaRishon is Korbanu, Nachshon ben Aminadav, the Mate Yehuda. Okay, Nachshon. What's the yichus of Nachshon? What's the yichus of Nachshon? He's the Nasi. The Nasi of each tribe brings for the korban. Brings for the tribe. Brings their korban. However, it's noteworthy. And what's fascinating is you can really go through these psukim many times, and we do, and not notice what the Or HaChaim is about to point out. The pasuk never introduces Nachshon as the Nasi of Shevet Yehuda. Now we know he's the Nasi, and he's been referred to in earlier in Bamidbar as the Nasi, and here he's just called by his name, which is very interesting. Are we meant to assume, we're just meant to know that he's the Nasi? Apparently. But then look at Yom HaSheni, which is Pasuk Yud Ches. Hayom Hasheni, on the second day, Hikriv Nisanel Ben Suar, Nisi Yisachar. So you see that when it comes to day two, it's Nisanel Ben Suar, we're told he's a Nasi. So even though we knew that also, but apparently it's titles as well. So how come Nachshon we're not told he's a Nasi? He's mentioned without being Nasi, and this and Nisanel is. But what's of further interest is that even with this Yom HaSheni, Nisanel Ben Suar, the order, first we hear his name, and then we hear that he's a Nasi. Why is that significant? Because from day three until the end, it will be reversed. If you look at day three, for example, Pasuk Kaf Dalet, Bayom HaShlishi, Nasi Lefnei Zevulun, Eliyahu Ben Chedor. First, he's introduced as Nasi, and then we hear his name. Likewise, Bayom HaRavi, Nasi Lefnei Ruvain, Elitzur Ben Chedor, and so it is until day 12. And therefore, again, as we look carefully, we see that the different individuals, there's basically, it's three tiers. You have Nachshon, we don't hear that he's a Nasi at all. You have Nisanel, we do hear he's a Nasi at the end. And everyone else, we hear they're introduced as Nasi before anything else. What are we to make of all of this? Says Orachayim HaKadosh. The question as to whether or not we mention that the person is a Nasi, and when we mention that they're a Nasi, reflects the question of how much does the fact that they're Nasi, how much is that required in order for them to be eligible to offer a special korban in the Mishkan? As if to say, it's true, Nachshon's the Nasi, everyone knows that. But what's amazing about the situation is Nachshon doesn't need to be the Nasi in order to offer his korbanos. Nachshon has special credit because Nachshon is the one, as we know, he's the one that jumped into the Yamsuf, he's the one that got the whole thing going, and therefore he almost has as much right to bring a korban to participate in a special event like this, even if he wasn't a Nasi, and even though he is. But it's not mentioned, as if to say, all you have to say is Nachshon ben Aminadav, and he's in. That's it. He's so bound up with the Yetzias Mitzrayim events that he gets a pass. He can go straight to the Mishkan. Okay. Well, what about day two? Well, day two is Nisanel ben Suar. What do we know about him? Did he participate in Yetzias Mitzrayim? Did he jump into the Yom Tov? No. Is there anything special about him? Yes, says the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. Not with particular reference to Yetzias Mitzrayim, but with much more general reference, but it still makes a difference. Shevet Yisachar is the Shevet of Tamidei Chachamim. They're the Yodei Bina Le'itim. Of all the 12 that bring korbanos, they're known as a tribe of Torah scholars. And that makes a difference. It doesn't make all the difference in this respect, but you see that in deference to Shevet Yisachar's statement, we will hear that he's a Nasi. He needs to be the Nasi. But we hear his name first, because the two go together. It's a combination. It's amazing how gradiated it is. It's like a blend here. From day three onwards, it's got to be Nasi. It's nothing else, and therefore the word Nasi comes first. And this is how the Rachaim explains these three modes of presentation, which is really a Dovar Nifla. Just a final comment, back to Yisachar. This has been in my notes for about 12 years now, so Imein Achshav Eimasai. So Pasuk Yudches, Bayom HaSheni, Hikriv Nesana Ben Suar, Nesi Yisachar. Okay, we've spoken about the order, but on the second day, he's the one that brings. Pasuk Yudches, Hikriv Es Korbano, Karas Kesa Vachash, Lershim, Amayam, Mishkala, etc., etc. So what's unique actually about Yisachar, it's not true of day one or of any of the later days, is that he is mentioned as referred to as bringing his korban twice. Pasuk Yudches Bayom HaSheni Hikriv Nesana Ben Suar, and the Pasuk Yudches Hikriv is korbano. With all the others, it just says Hikriv once. And in Pasuk Yudches, it could have just said V'korbano Karas Kesed Achas. Why does it repeat the verb Hikriv as korbano? That's a good shaila. Says the Ksav Sofer. The Medrash tells us, and it's very apropos of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh, because he said that he pointed out Yisachar the Tamidei Chachamim. It happens to be, the Medrash tells us, that Yisachar was the one who really got the idea going that all of the Nesiim should bring these korbanos. In other words, according to the Medrash, it wasn't so much a spontaneous, they all were mechaven simultaneously to the same korbanos. It was Yisachar. Yisachar is a Talmud Chacham. He knows most about these things. And he got the chaveirim together, all the Nesiim, and says, it's Chanukah Samishkan, we should all bring korbanos. It should be like this. And they all agreed. But what that means is that Yisachar has a special role here as a Talmud Chacham. How so? Because on the one hand, he brings his own korbanos, but on the other hand, he is a force and an inspiration and initiative behind all of the other Nesiim bringing their korbanos. If you enable or inspire or educate someone to do a mitzvah, you have a chelik in that mitzvah. To a certain degree, you have a share, and it's like you did the mitzvah as well. And that, says the Ksav Sofer, is what is alluded to in this repetition. On the first time it says, Bayom HaSheni, on the second day, Hikriv Nesanel Ben Su'ar. That's his own korban. But then the pasuk goes on to say, Hikriv his korban now. He offered his korban. Who's his korban? All the other korbanos. He offered his and his and his and his. Here's where the pasuk is saying that all the other korbanos, day 1 and then day 3 from day 12, he krivas korbanos. He has a chelik in their korban as well, because he was the one who was behind the idea. It's a very wonderful interpretation of this kvelis, as we see for much of the repetition. It's important not to become dulled, because then we miss the nuances, specifically the aspects in which it is not a repetition. There's a departure. It says this only in this respect, with regards to that nosi, and not with the other. That's how the full message has come out. I will leave it over there for this evening.